Time out now to take a look at Parfomania in action against the Rock and Roll Express. This is something I think that rock and roll will long remember.
From Television City in Hollywood,
this podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 111 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winsett. And today, we'll be taking a look at CWA Memphis Wrestling from July 14th, 1984, a very familiar date in wrestling history. And this is something I kind of want to do where I actually do shows from various territories from what is commonly known as Black Saturday, the day that the World Wrestling Federation took over Georgia Championship Wrestling in the TBS time slot. Because I wonder to myself, what was going on in the AWA? What was going on in Central State? So today, we're going to find out what was going on in Memphis, in the land of Jerry Jarrett and Jerry Lawler and all the rest. Now, I've mentioned in the past couple of weeks that it was requested that I do more Memphis, and I had specifically mentioned two episodes last week, neither of which I am actually doing now. However, I had nailed it down to four finalists for this week that I'm going to get to all of these at various points because they all have their interesting things to them. One of them, from 1979, features the future Hulk Hogan and the future Brutus Beefcake side by side for an interview, and I believe they have a match as well. Also, very, very young Ricky Morton is in action pre-Rock and Roll Express. Morton is actually on this show in a very high-profile role, and you're going to be head over heels for what happens to him during this show. Also, that 1988 show that I had mentioned, which features a parking lot brawl between Eddie Gilbert and Jerry Lawler, and then a 2001 episode of Memphis Championship Wrestling when it was the developmental territory of the WWF that had a Bryan Danielson versus William Regal match, which I couldn't be more excited about any two people from the 21st century in the same ring. And that's excluding that match that I think they had on one of the one-off shows, like a Velocity or something, where they played Regal's Man music as a rib to him. And, you know, everybody had a good laugh. But today, it's 1984 Memphis. And part of it is because I wanted to get into that ultra-hot area from the territory, which is generally considered to be 82 to 86. I've done shows from 87 and 89, so after that. So I kind of want to land right in the middle of this. I want Jimmy Hart there. Obviously, I want Lawler on the show. I'm not as crazy about Bill Dundee for whatever reason, because I always see him as, yeah, he's like the other headliner in the territory, but quite frankly, I just prefer Jerry Lawler. But before I get into the show proper, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. More on Pro Wrestling Only and all that you can find there, including the great Walking in Memphis series, which is very important to read because it's gone back to the 70s where we don't necessarily have the footage that we have for the 1980s. So it's interesting reading about the origins of Lawler and Dundee in 1977, because the 80s stuff is all out there. You can actually see it. So you got to learn about the stuff that preceded it, I think. But before I get back to Memphis Wrestling, I have to describe couple of great aspects of my weekend, particularly on Saturday, which was somewhat historic for me because if you've listened to me for even 30 seconds, you know that I'm a huge Boston Bruins fan and a huge Baltimore Orioles fan. And they happened to be playing in Boston on the same day on Saturday, and I was actually able to attend both games, something that I've never done. I've actually gone to a Bruins and Red Sox game in the same day before. I did it back in 2013 on my birthday with a Red Sox-Astros game when the Astros were still terrible, so the Red Sox won that one, and then the Bruins choked away the division title at night against Ottawa or Florida. It doesn't really matter. All I know is that I was sick as a dog the next day, and it's the only time that I've called out sick from work in the last 7 or 8 years. I also went to a New Hampshire Fisher Cats and Manchester Monarchs game in the same day, but nobody really gives a shit about that. So on Saturday, I head in, as is my routine when I go to Fenway. I go to a bar, and I'm going to say that it's a presenting sponsor of Greetings from Allentown, because God knows I've spent enough money in that place. Bukowski's Bar on Dalton Street, where I don't turn up there all that often because I live 30 miles outside of Boston, but they seem to know who I am because I might just be the sort of quirky person that they actually remember, such as the guy who orders the Anchor Christmas beer even though it is April 13th. And I was more than happy to take that off their hands because that beer actually ages extremely well. And in talking to the bartender, she said that they got like a 30-liter keg and they got 10 liters left. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'll be able to make a little bit of a dent in that. But it's a 6.9% beer. You can't really have too many of it. So I have that, and then I head down to Fenway to see my Baltimore Orioles take on the evil defending world champion Boston Red Sox. And I made sure to get there for the first pitch because I'm not sure how much you follow baseball, but this is a human interest story. For one, Chris Crush Davis was 0 for his last 54, which you're saying, okay, is that bad? It is the worst stretch or worst hitless streak by any batter in the history of baseball who is not a pitcher. So yeah, I'd say that that's pretty bad. That's like 12 games without a hit. It's like the reverse DiMaggio. And I thought, today is the day he's going to get a hit. He may come up in the first inning. He's batting six. And sure enough, he comes up with the bases loaded and two outs and me praying to God.
Porcello out of the fold, wind up. Davis is going to get one. Base hit into right field. And Sadie will score. Smith will score. RBIs 1 and 2. And for Chris Davis, it's over, baby. We're not talking about it anymore. And the Orioles go on top 2-0.
Oh, that goes down so smooth. The great thing about rooting for a rebuilding baseball team is that the results don't matter, so you could just focus on little things like that. So, you know, they get a couple runs, they build a lead, then I go down into the concourse and talk to a listener to the program and former Wheel of Fortune contestant Ken Depot, which I should have talked about that with him more because I kind of dream on being on a game show at some point, probably Jeopardy, because I feel like that should be my destiny, you know, given that my dad watched it religiously and, you know, it would be like, oh, I dedicate this victory to my late father and all that stuff. So I stayed on the concourse, talked to him for like an inning and a half, and he participated. He's the second participant in my new Beertreon program. See, other podcasts have a Patreon where you donate money and you get all these benefits. And I don't know if I can ever really get into that because I don't know if I'll have time unless I just start doing a ton of podcasts from my car, just talking, which I may well do. I may just record my Monday or Friday commute every single week and post it. I mean, I don't know if I could really talk for 40 consecutive minutes. I mean, who knows? Like I said, I break these up into 5-minute chunks. Yeah, buy me a Sam76, always going to ingratiate yourself to me. But I actually have a video from him that I'll be covering, I believe, next week from the NWA from 1985. So the Orioles end up winning that game 9-5, hanging out with my friends in the bleachers in Section 41, which the Orioles have a 9-2 lead. And my friend's brother, like, wants me to bet $10 to win one that, oh, yeah, the Orioles are going to win this game. I'm like, no, I'm not interested in doing that because, first of all, I've seen the Orioles bullpen. And second of all, I just don't have the tolerance for that sort of risk, even though it would have been fairly easy money at the end of the day. So at the end of the game, what do? Of course I go back to Bukowski's bar because I got to kill a couple of hours before the Bruins game. But I'm not going to drink too much. I had a couple more Anchor Christmas and some food. Walk back to my car so that I can kind of, you know, get it out of my system a little bit. And the Boston Marathon going on this past Monday, but everything's all set up for it, and to kind of walk through that area is always rather interesting. It's a lot of the area shut down to traffic. They didn't always do that in the past, but obviously the security concerns and all that now it's a little bit different than it was, say, prior to 6 years ago, when you could drive down that street on the Sunday before and they would only close it on Marathon Monday. So I just laid in my car for 15 minutes. I went back to my car. I was parked at the garage. And I think I listened to Thank God I'm a Country Boy on a loop for 12 minutes. I don't recall what happened. I don't think I dozed off or anything. But head on down to the Bruins-Toronto Maple Leafs playoff game. And the Bruins were victorious in that one. That series is still going on. Now, as I record this, I'm recording this right after Game 3 has ended, which was won by Toronto. So big ups to me for not being all despondent and shit, where I have to go out into the garage and cut cardboard to just kind of, you know, get it all out of my system. I feel okay. I need to rewind a second to the Red Sox game, because there's something very peculiar, and I have no idea how Greetings from Allentown came up amongst the people around me, who, as I'm wearing my bright orange Orioles jersey, which you may have seen if you follow the Our Vantage Point Twitter from the MSG when I had the picture taken with those guys, and I'm wearing the bright orange Cal Ripken 1988 Orioles jersey. So it came up that I do a podcast, and I said, look, I do a wrestling podcast, and most of the stuff I do is from the 80s that people remember. And this woman, who I thought I had her pegged for her mid-30s, now she said that she would be listening to the show. I think that there's absolutely no way she remembers the conversation we had at Fenway Park last Saturday. So if she does remember, she should email me at greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, or, you know, send me something on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod, because she spoke up and said, oh my God, I loved Mike Rotundo and Barry Windham. And she said Mike Rotundo's name first, which I thought was very interesting. But then I thought to myself, yeah, she named the two members of the U.S. Express. So now there should be no doubt in people's mind of how crazy popular they were at that time, even though I think a lot of it had to do with the Bruce Springsteen music. Had they kept Real American, maybe that would have helped them too. But you're coming out to a Bruce Springsteen song when he's red hot. I think that you know, was kind of part of it as well. I don't look at Mike Rotundo as much of a sex pot, but, you know, I saw her, I thought this woman was probably like 34, 35 years old, which would make her like 2 when the U.S. Express was around. So clearly, you know, credit to her for looking 7, 8 years younger than she probably is, because I figure she'd probably be 10 or 11 at that point in 85. I don't know, I'm terrible at estimating people's ages, and I'm also terrible at remembering people's heights. I'm also terrible at remembering people's names, which is a real tragedy, because I can remember obscure shit that happened in Bruins games from 1999, but I can't remember the name of the person that I was introduced to 10 minutes before. It's a real problem. There's a lot going on in my head. So yeah, this is part of my initiative to increase the female listenership of this podcast. I think I can triple it, because I think that there are 4 or 5 of you out there, and I think that I can get the number up to 15 or 20. So that would be an increase of 3 or 4-fold. I mean, I could go to advertisers at that point and say, look at my female listenership relative to other wrestling podcasts of my type. Now, yeah, I'm not Conrad or anything like that, but I'm just kind of thinking of the demographics, and I'm speaking also as somebody who has absolutely no idea how many people listen to this podcast. The little number that comes up on the SoundCloud, not sure I entirely buy that, because I think that it might be overcounting stuff and not counting certain stuff at the same time. I don't quite get it. So on Sunday, I got the idea for my birthday, finally. Not going to have a party at my house, because you got to do cleanup, you got to cook stuff on the grill. What I'm going to do is I'm going to hang out at a tap room with my wife, and I'm going to say, look, you want to come by and say hi? You know, that would be great. You could bring a pizza there. You could bring calzones, because usually most of these tap rooms are BYOB, because we went to this place called Oak and Iron in Andover, Mass. A very good brewery. It's right along a river. And it was effectively like two taproom experiences in one, because we sat outside, of like right up against the river by the railing. Unfortunately, we were surrounded by some of the worst dog owners in the history of Western civilization. They let their dogs just bark loudly at each other for an interminable amount of time. And then one of them had their, you know, tubby kid like threaten the dog, like pretending to like jump at him or whatever. Like, yeah, spook the dog there, fatty. Why don't you go have a few more French fries? So eventually we just decide, screw this. We're going to move inside. And we're looking around at people, and there were these two that, you know, my wife is very, very mean in this kind of situation. And I got to say, I love it. It's fantastic. Like, she looks at one person like, boy, I'm glad those two found each other. And yeah, they weren't good-looking people, but you didn't have to say that out loud. And then there was a woman across who definitely had a wedgie. Now, I'm not allowed to point that out. But because she pointed that out, I was able to give my observations on it as well. And then she went into a whole thing on the dangers of avalanche ass, which is not to be confused with an ass avalanche. If you look it up on Urban Dictionary, completely different thing. Avalanche ass is, you know, not having it, you know, it's where it droops down and it just doesn't look good in the back. And it was very entertaining to do that. So that's something I definitely want on my birthday, is for people to just do their stand-up on other people and just roast the hell out of everybody around us. That is what I enjoy in my life. And also having beer there at the same time is great. But above all, this is a wrestling podcast, so I need to get back to Memphis wrestling from July 14th, 1984. And like I said, this is Black Saturday for some. But Memphis, like I always say, is its own world, kind of like how ECW is. And as I said, I chose this from several different ones, and I wanted to be in that really hot period, because while I may not know the exact number of people who listen to this podcast, I do know that people tend to really like stuff with Randy Savage in it. And this is the show with Randy Savage in it, where he is in Memphis in 84 and 85, because the Poffos, him and his brother Lanny and Angelo, their dad, had run an opposition promotion, ICW, or the quote-unquote outlaw promotion, which is the term I've said I always hated, because there's no such thing as an outlaw promotion in theory. It's just that they're running against, like, the NWA cartel or whatever. I think competition is good no matter how you cut it, although some people who remember the Knoxville Wrestling War of 79 might have said, a little bit too much there. But anyway, they're running in opposition to Jarrett's territory from 78 to 84. So once that goes under in 84, once that dies, now Savage can come in to face Lawler in Memphis. And it's a natural rivalry, because it is a real interpromotional feud. This is what the Invasion could have been in 2001, where you have a Randy Savage type instead of, you know, Booker T. I mean, Booker T is perfectly fine, but Savage is a mega star, obviously not the level he would be later. And in fact, I think kind of this little gestation period before he goes to WWF is probably critical for him to kind of develop that character just a little bit more. And over the last few years, basically since I've been watching wrestling again since 2014, Jerry Lawler, I've gained such a greater appreciation for him, in part because everything Memphis related, when I watched wrestling during the Attitude Era, you see him as the announcer. So you didn't really think of him as this legend from Memphis, other than, you know, kind of this thing that you would read. You'd never see the week-to-week Jerry Lawler, because YouTube didn't exist. I wasn't into the whole tape trading thing or anything like that. The guy had incredible staying power for multiple decades. We're talking on a Bruno Sammartino level in Memphis. And yeah, there were points where the crowd did get sick of him at times. I mean, 89 and into 90, Lawler did have a bit of a heel run, and he was a heel at the points in the 70s as well. But he is the man for this territory for the entire time. And I ain't talking about Becky Lynch. Randy Savage, on the other hand, he stays for about a year before going to the WWF. But in I've put over the Walking in Memphis series on ProWrestlingOnly.com, and I'm particularly fascinated with Memphis because I'm asking the question to myself, is this the most fun wrestling territory that there is? It doesn't have some of the baggage, I don't think, that some of the other places do. When you watch World Class, what's the first thing you think of? You think of the Von Erichs dying. When you watch the UWF, you think, well, this is good, and a lot of these guys are very good when they come to the WWF later and are more famous then, but then you also think of Bill Watts and how he's a colossal dick a lot of the time. So with the various territories, you kind of run into that issue. With Florida, you can't help but think of, you know, Eddie Graham and how that all went down. And maybe it's just somebody who has looked at this a little bit more, like Dusty Rhodes abandoning Championship Wrestling from Florida and taking all of his guys with him and kind of ruining the territory in the process, which may or may not have led to Eddie Graham's suicide. I don't know. But with Memphis, they have one thing that these other territories do not have, and that is Lance Russell at the commentary desk, because to me, he is Vin Scully. He could have done every single show on Memphis TV by himself, and it would have been fine. However, I also like Dave Brown as well, because he plays, I think, his role perfectly and makes it so that, you know, Lance doesn't have to fill the entire hour of wrestling and can kind of chime in with various observations. Because you think, oh, Dave Brown is just some weatherman. Well, Bob Caudle was a weatherman, too. And Dave Brown has a few good observations on this show that I could point out. So it's not like he's just some buffoon. But watching it on a week-to-week basis, there's an excitement that's there in that studio. And while you're familiar with a lot of the people who are there, even the ones that you might not be as familiar with, that's where Lance and Dave come in and can kind of help draw you in, even when you're looking back on something that is 35 years old. So that is one hell of a long intro, because I really had to get into everything that happened on Saturday and Sunday. It was really a high-quality weekend. And this is episode number 111. So I'm going to be doing sports moments from the year 2011. Now, I know what you're thinking. Pete, the Bruins won the Stanley Cup in 2011. Are you just going to play like 10 Bruins highlights and just only talk about that? To which I'd say, no, I'm not going to do that, because I'm going to tack that all on at the end of the show, so that if you want to listen to it, you can. And if you don't, well, tough shit, because you're probably going to get a lot of them in episode 113 a few weeks from now. So without any further ado, why don't I kick off this show with something from 2011.
They put Bosch on Nowitzki on this possession.
Seven to shoot. Nowitzki drives with underneath lefty layup, banks it in with 3.6 remaining. Miami out of timeouts, trailing by two. James back to Wade. Wade puts it up for the win. Off the mark, and Dallas has tied the finals with one of the most incredible comebacks in NBA Finals history.
I don't want it to go forgotten that Dirk Nowitzki and the Dallas Mavericks won the 2011 NBA championship, although Mark Cuban would probably speak up and remind us of it any chance he would get. I mean, I wasn't paying much attention to those finals, but I was glad that he won one that year, especially against the Wade, Bosch, LeBron Heat that was, you know, rather loathsome given the way that they all gathered together that one season. It's interesting because I was talking to my friend Dave when I met him at the bar before going to the G1 Supercard at MSG, and we were talking about Dirk and how he was retiring, and I was like, well, this is one hell of a farewell tour. You get Doc Rivers like pumping him up over the PA system, and he told me, he said, you know that Dirk had never announced his retirement? And I was like, what? I like turned into Sheila Broflovsky. And he said, yeah, he never actually announced his retirement going in. Everybody just kind of assumed that he was going to retire. And he did after the last game of the season, because he said, I don't want no Derek Jeter-style farewell tour or anything like that. So good for Dirk Nowitzki. I mean, the guy was an honest player for 20 years in the NBA, just incredible longevity, and did a lot for the game in Europe. That should not go unstated as well.
Hello again, everybody. Lance Russell and Dave Brown, and we are right here ready to go with another, and I mean really big day on Championship Wrestling.
Love to hear Lance Russell doing the old Ed Sullivan really big show bit. And to a generation of Americans, you'd see him on television every single week. That's one thing. But to me, who's born years after the Ed Sullivan show had gone off the air, all I can ever think of is he's a guy who wore a shirt.
That guy always wore a shirt.
Ed Sullivan?
Yeah.
Lance and Dave run down the lineup for today's show, which I somehow failed to do during my very lengthy intro. A lot of tag team matches coming up with Phil Hickerson and the Spoiler, Dutch Mantel teaming with Porkchop Cash, the New Hollywood Blondes and the New Generation, and then the team of Poffomania. And yes, this is what Lanny Poffo and his brother, the Macho Man Randy Savage, were calling themselves at this time. Immediately, it just hits my ear that, oh, Poffomania is just stolen from Hulkamania, because here we are in the middle of 84, and he's ramping up as WWF champion after a few months now. But then Hulkamania itself, the whole term, was stolen from Beatlemania in the 60s, to bring it right back to Ed Sullivan. But Beatlemania is a ripoff of Liztomania, who was an 1840s Hungarian pianist who apparently was very popular. I don't know much about it, you know, other than that. I mean, when it comes to the great pianists, unless you're talking about Mozart and Beethoven, I kind of stop at Scott Joplin around 1900 with his ragtime stuff. So anyway, they are on the show. We're going to get a clip of them again, at least a clip of them against the Rock and Roll Express, which is a rather historic match for something that happens. And then a six-man match, which is their TV time remaining match. So the one at the very end, which features Jerry the King Lawler and the Fabulous Ones together in a six-man unit in Memphis, which is like basically seeing the Super Friends.
We are the Super Friends!
Hey, shut up.
We actually start with Masao Ito taking on Tony Torres. And Ito has Jimmy Hart as his manager, which is always odd to these WWF eyes because of how Jimmy, not exactly the guy who would be with the foreign heels when he gets to the WWF, at least from a non-North American perspective. Yeah, you could throw him with Dino Bravo, but he doesn't leave the continent, basically, for the heels that he manages. But in Memphis, he was the only manager, to the point where if another heel manager actually came in, Jimmy would kind of ally himself with other guys to try and drive him out. He's very, you know, sort of, there was an antitrust issue perhaps with Jimmy Hart and his managing. Jimmy Hart in Memphis, he's like the Ma Bell of wrestling managers. So Tony Torres, I'd like to say something interesting about him, but in looking into his background, it's much more interesting things going on with his family history, because his father was a wrestler dating back to the 40s, Enrique Torres, a big star in Southern California in the 1950s when wrestling was starting to come all over TV in that area. He was the Pacific champion, or the Los Angeles world champion, as it would have been at that time. Faced Gorgeous George, Luthez, among others. Now, his brother also wrestled and died as a result of a ruptured pancreas that happened during a match, which sounds particularly awful. As for Tony Torres, there's really not a whole lot to go on, because there's just not too much in the history. He was born 1940, so he's a little bit long in the tooth even at this point. Ito, Masao Ito, a bit of a short-timer in Memphis. He doesn't have a particularly long stay. He's part of the talent swap that comes over from Mid-South in late 83 and 84. That was the same deal that brought Rick Rude to Memphis, where he kind of started to make his name a little bit. And speaking of names, just looking at Masao Ito, you see that last name and you think of it, well, is how common is that name? Because you know a few other famous people named Ito. It is the sixth most common Japanese surname. Now, in terms of famous people named Ito, he certainly ranks behind Judge Lance Ito, the infamous judge from the O.J. Simpson case, but also well behind Japanese figure skating sensation Midori Ito, who competed in the Winter Olympics in 1988 and 92, was the first woman to land a triple axel in, I don't know if it was Olympic competition or just international competitions in general, but she could certainly get up on her jumps. Think of her as the Will Ospreay of her time from a figure skating, except I actually liked watching Midori Ito skate. She won a silver medal at the Albertville Olympics in 1992 and then apologized to her country for not coming home with gold, which is just so incredibly Japanese. She also happens to be Dave Meltzer's favorite figure skater of all time, and she lit the flame at the 1998 Winter Olympics in Nagano, Japan. So, yeah, Masao Ito has a long way to go if he wants to get there. So he attacks early, and this is where I notice, because his back is to the hard camera, very large ass on Masao Ito. Like, him and Jimmy Valiant in, like, a reverse sumo match where they just go butt-to-butt with each other would be one hell of a match, I would imagine. Imagine. And he just stomps Torres's ass for quite a while, falling headbutt, and he is not wasting any time at all. He's going fast through all of his moves. Like, he will knock the guy over and then he will pick him up right away. There's no preening for the crowd or any of that.
Tony has got to get, he's a fine basic wrestler, excellent style and a lot of speed, but he never had a chance. Ito slowed him down before he got started, and Tony just can't get off the ropes. Ito just wearing him out.
Good on Lance for speaking up for Tony Torres. Like, no, he really doesn't look this bad most of the time, people. It's just that Ito got the jump on him. And I never thought I would sit here and be like, boy, I really enjoyed that Masao Ito squash match. But here we are, and he hits a falling headbutt, which wins it for him at 79 seconds and crammed in a lot of stuff. Now, Jimmy Hart is at ringside saying that that falling headbutt is called Bombs Over Tokyo. Which I feel like is kind of weird, because isn't he from Japan? Wouldn't he be looking to, I don't know, avoid bombs over Tokyo? I mean, I don't know. I'm just glad they didn't say that he Pearl Harbored Torres at the beginning of the match. That kind of became cliched. Thank you very much, Gorilla Monsoon. I think Lance Russell put it best in this one, where he said that Torres was subjected to everything that Ito had. And yeah, he probably went through his entire moveset in 79 seconds.
Kane swings it across, Ryan Johnson back. Turned over. Cam Hughes. He'll give it away. Campoli gave it away. Burrows walks in. He's got it. Stanley Cup champions in seven games.
If anything, playing an Alex Burrows highlight should prove how much of a good sport I am, given the stuff that he would do later on. Game 7, Vancouver versus Chicago Blackhawks, a depleted Blackhawks team, because they had won the cup the year before and then had to trade a bunch of guys because of the salary cap. They basically went for it in the 1 year in 2010 and won their Stanley Cup. That was a great Game 7 that I can't even put into words. Like, I remember one specific thing from it. Well, actually, two. The Blackhawks tie the game with under 2 minutes to go, shorthanded by Jonathan Toews on a great individual effort, as I recall. And yes, you get the Burrows overtime winner. But the number one thing I remember about that game was sitting on my couch underneath a blanket watching it, and the Blackhawks get a power play at the beginning of overtime. And I'm like, oh my God, the Blackhawks might come from 3-0 down and win this series. It would just be an incredible collapse by the Canucks, who had the best record in the NHL that year. And as the power play is about to begin, as they're about to drop a puck, emergency broadcast system comes on the TV. Now, mind you, it's 1 in the morning, local time here, and they decide to have the EAS emergency alert system right then and there. And it was on the, it was 20 scary seconds, and I couldn't yell anything because my wife is upstairs asleep. Just like, what the hell? And there's actual guidelines that you're not supposed to do that during major sporting events, which I guess does not bode well for the NHL, because there's a Game 7 going on, and they did it right in the middle of overtime. So now we have the spoiler, and I'm going to spoil this for you because it's not the real spoiler. It's Frank Morrell, basically the Memphis spoiler, because he was primarily working in the Jarrett and Gulas territories before that. He's teaming with Phil Hickerson, taking on Jim Jameson and Lou Winston. Oh, I'm very excited to see Lou Winston here in action. As somebody who has been called Winston by accident for much of my life, I'm so happy that there's a pro wrestler. And I have to ask the question, are he and I any relation?
Unlikely, sir. They They spell and pronounce their name differently.
Well, at least you didn't go right to the thing of, well, Lou Winston is African-American, Pete, and you're not. You're as white as rice. But anyway, so the spoiler is left on his own for the beginning of this match, because Phil Hickerson apparently just has sort of a wandering eye and wants to do lots of different things. So he heads over to the commentary desk, and this is one of the best parts of Lance Russell, is his disgust with the heels. Yeah, he has a nice back and forth with Terry Funk that I covered on a 1989 NWA show, but Lance always so great just kind of having that fatherly reaction to the heels who are acting like obnoxious 10-year-olds.
Hey, Phil. Phil, the sound, and we're off and running. Oh, swell. Yeah, you make my day every time you come around, Phil.
What y'all talk about today, man?
What I'd like to do is for Dave and I to talk about the matches going on.
Well, don't let him talk. Won't you tell him? Look how great the spoiler is. Don't you think he's good this morning? I'll tell you what, I talked to him all night. You know, that's one of the best wrestlers today. You know why? He's good. He's real good. He's not as good as I am, but I'll tell you what, he's good. You know what I mean?
Marvelous.
Hey, them guys right there, man, they're great.
Coming in with Jim Jameson.
Jim, that's one of the best wrestlers I ever witnessed. I'm telling you.
Okay, Phil.
Already struggling.
I know.
That was a real good move right there, right?
Lance reacting to Phil Hickerson like a cat who won't stop meowing. It's like, yeah, you'll get your food in a little bit. Yeah, all right, we've heard it all before. Meanwhile, the spoiler is just taking care of Jim Jameson in the ring. And Jameson is getting his ass kicked so much, he kind of looks like his namesake. And that could mean either Jameson from the WWF, or I could mean that he drank a lot of Jameson. It could be either one. Terrible clothesline by this Memphis spoiler, who then pulls up Jameson from the pin. At which point I figure, well, he's going to throw him into the corner and now give Lou Winston a shot. But Phil Hickerson, he just keeps talking. Now, they're the AWA Southern Tag Team Champs. I was wondering what the deal was with the belts that they had on. And the AWA had this sort of loose affiliation with Memphis at this point. Phil says that they should just kill the boy and be done with it, which felt like a weird thing. But again, at least he referred to Jameson as the boy, because if he had referred to the African-American man as a boy, that has a completely different connotation. And a back suplex finishes this match off, and I am left scratching my head because poor Lou Winston didn't even get into this freaking match. I had levels of jobber tag teams where, like, most of them are allowed one tag, but if you're allowed two or three tags, that means you're a little bit higher cut above the usual jobber tag team. Here, the guy doesn't even get to tag out of the match. It's basically like a singles match between the spoiler and Jim Jameson. So, I don't know. Lou Winston never gets into the match. 3:18. I mean, I think Winston from Ghostbusters got more respect than this.
Tuesday night right there at the Louisville Gardens. Wow, what a night of action that is.
This is actually the Louisville feed of the Memphis territory. I know previously I looked at the Evansville feed, so they got the local promos. And Tuesday night at Louisville Gardens is a tradition back in the day and is now a book by Jim Cornette and Mark James that I believe you can purchase on Amazon. On that next card in Louisville, you got Tommy Rich, who is going to be facing off against Rick Rude in the battle of the four-letter last names. Also, Randy Savage and Lanny Poffo against the Rock and Roll Express. But we're more worried about Rick Rude versus Tommy Rich, because we have Rude, who is with Jimmy Hart, of course, because he is the manager of record, like I said. Also, very interesting to me that Rick Rude, somebody that you associate with Bobby Heenan when he's on a larger stage later, here with Jimmy Hart. And it's not, it actually feels okay. If he had been with Jimmy Hart in the WWF, it would have been perfectly fine. What's funny is that Rick Rude, one of the few guys who did not like having Bobby Heenan as his manager, he said that he thought that the Brain was always trying to steal his heat, which I think might have been his own paranoia. I know, the guy who kept a gun in the trunk of his car was paranoid. I can't believe it. I'm not going to bust Rick Rude's balls for that. I mean, God knows that the steroid use may have actually done it for me or whatever. So Rude, he's going to find his way back to my heart, and that's by quoting Bruce Springsteen lyrics.
You know, you better believe it. You know, when Rick Rude signed me to handle all of his affairs for him, he said, look, Jimmy, I want to stay in the gym. I want to lift weights. I want to get myself in the best condition possible, and I want you to sign the best people we can bring in. And look at Tommy Rich. He's big. He's bad. He's, what, 6'3", 225 pounds? But this is the king of professional wrestling right now, Rick Rude, baby.
Yeah.
The only thing bad about Tommy Rich, Jimmy, is his looks. Let me tell you something. You can't start a fire without a spark. And Tommy Rich, you're not even going to get a chance to spark, brother. Lance, take a look at that punk. Looks like he should be sitting up in the audience drinking beer and watching the matches. Just goes to show you what kind of champion I am. An equal opportunity champion. I'll even give a chump like Tommy Rich a shot. Bring it on down, Tommy Rich, and we'll see just where you end up on the mat like everybody else, punk.
Dancing in the Dark was the first single off Born in the USA, so it does make sense that he would know that lyric because it was getting a ton of radio airplay, made it to number two, but never made it to number one because it was blocked by, I think it was Duran Duran's The Reflex and When Doves Cry by Prince. So that's a shame. Although I like to track these songs that only make it to number two and just can never get up to number one for whatever reason. I mean, he had seven songs off that album that charted. And if he had included My Love Will Not Let You Down on the album as well, it would have been eight. But hey, I guess those are the breaks. One big distinction between Rude then and the long-haired Lothario that you would see in the WWF is his mustache is slightly different. Now, not to turn into Parv here, but his mustache actually comes around like a Fu Manchu. In WWF, it was more like the just general push broom, but there it kind of goes down on the lip ever so slightly. But if you want to work in the World Wrestling Federation, you cannot have the same facial hair as Hulk Hogan. I mean, that's just not going to work, brother. And then, of course, he wouldn't even be able to work with Hogan because he hit him in the freaking head with the corner of a wooden chair at a Boston show in January of 1988. It's one of the craziest things I've ever seen. But hey, Rick Rude, he was often a bit of a crazy bastard when you think about it. A lot of permutations in Rick Rude's career. And if you want to discuss some more, I know where you can go. ProWrestlingOnly.com. Explore other podcasts such as WorldCast, Strong Style Story, Military Industrial Suplex, and the rest, along with match reviews, features, retrospectives, reviews of wrestling books, video games, matches, playlists, wrestler appearances in non-wrestling TV shows, movies, and more, such as Rick Rude on the Arsenio Hall show, which, if I ever get to do my Arsenio Hall special, I don't know if Rude's appearance will make the cut necessarily, because the two definites, of course, are Hulk Hogan and Bad News Brown. But I don't know, I'll have to see. There was also the Twin Towers appeared on our video, which is also quite hilarious. But join the conversation, signing up at the Pro Wrestling Only forums, online for over a decade with over 2,000 registered members. Message board is a very vibrant community. Whether you want to talk about a specific match in the match discussion archive from the whole list of Rick Rude eras, take a deep dive in microscope form, or discuss more general topics from wrestling's past and present. Check all of that out and more at ProWrestlingOnly.com.
Stewart, second effort, dropped it on now. Motoring in is Datsuk. Datsuk, a backhander. He scores! My goodness! And the lead for the Sharks is won.
Guess this is me once again highlighting a play from a loss that I want to make sure never gets forgotten. Pavel Datsuk in Game 7 of the second round against the San Jose Sharks in 2011, simply because he scored on a backhander from outside the faceoff circles from about 30 to 35 feet away from the net. I cannot possibly stress enough how difficult of a shot that is. It's one of the greatest things I've ever seen. And it's not even the greatest Datsuk shot I've ever seen. That would be a 2010 shootout winner against Chicago. Just, you know, type into your YouTube machine, Datsuk shootout Chicago, something like that. Or I should just make a GIF file of it, which I should have done last week. But sometimes the hockey stuff doesn't come off as well, where I have to actually stress how great of a shot that was. They ended up losing that game 3-2, and that goal was scored with about 2 minutes left, so it got them back into the game. So up next, we have a rather interesting tag team match. I have no idea why I find it interesting. The team of Pat Hutchinson and Jesse Owens, no, not that Jesse Owens, taking on Porkchop Cash and Dirty Dutch Mantel. And the first thing that I notice here, as the teams are being introduced, is when Mantel's name is said, there are women screaming for him in the crowd. And I'm thinking, what is going on? These women love their bears, apparently, given how hairy Dutch Mantel is. And maybe that's why Memphis kept the name the Grizzlies when they moved from Vancouver. It's some sort of weird homage to Dutch Mantel years later. That's the only thing that makes sense to me. Still working on the Utah Jazz. I don't know what the hell that is. And the Los Angeles Lakers, given that there are no lakes there. So old Porkchop, I think he was a WWF enhancement talent in 1988 that I may have covered in an earlier episode. He was a champion in L.A., much like that Torres' dude dad, but in 1974, and he'd be off to Southeastern Wrestling later here in 84. He was one half of the Bruise Brothers, but not at all like the Harris Twins of later vintage and the same name, old Porkchop being African-American. Probably wouldn't see eye to eye with the two Harris Twins. Pat Hutchinson passed away in 2006 at the age of 49, so quite young, but he had an actual real-life job. This was just, I think, sort of a side thing because he was an enhancement guy in Memphis for many years. He was a tax investigator for the county government. So it kind of makes me think, maybe he should have been given the IRS gimmick. He would have had a little bit more oomph behind it. He would have had certain understanding of the issues and all that. And as we started, is Porkchop and Hutch, who do a decent little amateur sequence. I mean, especially since one of the guys is a tax agent and the other guy is named Porkchop. They use the ropes to break. And this is something that I only really think of from time to time, the psychology of rope breaks and how it's quote-unquote the easy way out. Sometimes Jesse Ventura would bring this up, and Dave Brown makes kind of a similar point to what Jesse would say.
Hutchinson hooks his legs over the rope. That's a smart move. I know that's one that wrestling fans don't like to see, and they get upset sometimes when they see wrestlers use the ropes. But when you're in trouble, that's a quick way to get the hole broken without much damage being done to you. And that's what Hutchinson did.
I know that's probably the only comparison of Jesse Ventura and Dave Brown that has ever been made in all of human history, but I prefer common sense announcing, and that tends to be what those guys actually bring, so it's something that they have in common. Hutchinson gets trapped in the corner as Dave and Lance suggest that maybe Dutch and Porkchop could take down the Spoiler and Phil Hickerson, which they actually did battle over those tag titles around this time. They got vacated for a week, and then the following week, Spoiler and Hickerson ended up winning it back against Cash and Mantell. Get a tag to Jesse Owens, who did not win 4 medals at the Berlin Olympics. This guy, while African-American, is not very fast and never dealt any sort of blow to Nazism or the whole doctrine of racial supremacy or any of that stuff. So he just tags back out really quickly. That's pretty much the only thing he does with any sort of speed. And Mantell gets back in as it's Dutch versus Hutch at this point. And this one's a little bit dull as they slow it down. And then finally Mantell, or Dirty as I like to call him, lays on a big lariat because he's billed from Texas. So he's allowed to actually use the name Lariat. There is not very much here in terms of excitement. I kind of wish we had more singles matches on this show, because a lot of times when you have these sort of tag matches, they end up looking the same. Well, except for the one earlier where freaking Lou Winston couldn't even get into the match. At least we got to see the great Jesse Owens for a few seconds before he got the hell out of there. Oh, well.
I know I'm not really scheduled to be out here right now, but I saw a guy in the back fixing to come out here, and before he came out, I just wanted to come out for just a second.
Yeah, you said you wanted to talk about something.
Well, it's just, I want to talk about this guy that's going to come out here and kind of maybe reintroduce him to a lot of the people. I see a lot of real young folks out there that might not necessarily remember this guy.
An episode of Memphis Wrestling without a Jerry Lawler promo is like a day without sunshine, or like an episode of the Baseball Bunch without Johnny Bench. I've been watching a lot of Baseball Bunch on YouTube recently, which is why I would say something odd like that. So it's now time for, I guess, story time with the King, for lack of a better term. And he's going to introduce a very old friend of his, and as a nice little bonus, we get the story of the King's first match.
The promoters, what you would do, you could naturally, you know, you beg for months or years or whatever. You beg the promoters, you say, look, I've worked hard, I've trained and everything, but the main thing is, you could be the greatest wrestler in the world. If you never get a match, nobody's going to know it. So you beg the promoters, please give me a chance. I'll wrestle anybody just to prove to you how bad I want to wrestle, you know. And I was on the phones every day talking to the promoters up in Nashville. I said, please, you know, I really want to wrestle. And they finally, they said, okay, we're going to give you a match. It was over in Jonesboro, Arkansas. And they put me against this guy, and I found out later they would take all the young wrestlers who were trying to get into wrestling, and they would put them against this guy, and he would beat you, I mean, so bad, unmercifully. He would, I mean, you know, when you'd have to crawl or be carried out of the ring, and he would give you such a beating that if you call the promoters back and said after that match, if you ever called him again and said you wanted to wrestle again, then they knew you had some potential. Because, you know, if you would come back after that, you wanted to wrestle. And then what they would do is they would book you against this guy in your second match. And, I mean, you know, it was like over and over, because he would beat you so bad that he really gave you a great indoctrination to wrestling. And the guy I'm talking about, and I want to bring him out here right now, is Tojo Yamamoto. And I haven't seen him in a long time.
Tojo was 57 at this point, but he was really an icon in Tennessee wrestling dating back, you know, a number of decades at this point. And one of the things he was most famous for was a promo that, it's from the Slam Wrestling article on Yamamoto from, I want to say it's from 2006, because all those Slam articles tend to be, like, from the exact same time. It's like a guy wrote all of them, and they're all from the same year, and then he never wrote anything in any other year. It's kind of like my old blog between the end of 2015 and the beginning of 2016. In an often told story, Yamamoto was booked in Boaz, Alabama. I hope I'm pronouncing that correct. He asked to make a statement prior to the match, and the crowd booed. In broken English, he lamented, "I wish make apology. Very sorry, my country bum Pearl Haba." The audience quieted and expressed sympathy while Yamamoto wiped away tears. He continued, "It was wrong thing to do. I wish not happen." And the spectators applaud. Yamamoto exclaimed, "I wish not happen because I wish they bomb Boaz." Well, that's how you draw heat back then. Also for, you know, playing a Japanese character even though he was actually born in Hawaii. So that, I mean, that's par for the course of wrestling at the time period. So Lawler's first match against Yamamoto, as the story goes, back then. But eventually, at some point in the future, Lawler got revenge with a rib on good old Tojo that he told the Jackson Sun in a 2015 interview. So I guess this isn't from 2006 if it's referencing a 2015 interview. "Tojo was getting ready for a match, and I snuck out into his locker room and climbed on top of the lockers while he was in the restroom. The only thing in the world Tojo was afraid of was snakes, and I had a very realistic-looking rubber snake that I threw down on him when he was lacing his boots. I gave myself away when I started laughing at him when he started jumping and screaming, and he actually pulled a gun on me out of his bag, screaming, 'I shoot you, you son of a gun!' He'd never cuss, but he was ready to shoot me that night." So what you're saying is that would be why Tojo never had a feud with Jake Roberts at any point. And he was very loyal to the Gulas territory after Jerry Jarrett split off in 1977. So he actually stayed where he was. He was, you know, Memphis, sometimes there was a tendency to underpay pretty much everybody except the tippy-top guys, and Yamamoto was one of those guys. So Tojo is back in the territory, and tell us, Mr. Yamamoto, what do you have planned?
Well, Mr. Ron Russell, I've been wrestling little and training little, and I went on vacation.
Just taking some time out, and you have been training some people and doing a little wrestling yourself.
Little wrestling myself, yes, sir.
Uh-huh. Well, by golly, I'll tell you what, this is one guy that has been in there with every top wrestler in the United States.
And that is a fact. Now, I don't know if he has it in his bio where wrestled Ric Flair to a 60-minute draw necessarily, but Hulk Hogan made up a story about wrestling him where Tojo took a cigar from a guy in the front row and then dropped it into Hogan's boot, which I'm only assuming is complete nonsense because it's Hulk Hogan who said it. He trained so many guys, Tojo did, dating from Jerry Jarrett, which tells you how far back he goes to, I guess it would go all the way back to the 60s in that case. He also trained Jeff Jarrett, of course, Sid Vicious, it says, the Moondogs, Spike and Spot, Bobby Eaton. I mean, that's one to show off on the resume. Tommy Rich also listed as being trained by Tojo Yamamoto. So I just keep wondering, okay, are they bringing him out to just say a few words and say hello to the fans, or is he actually going to stick around and do something?
And I get caught again from these, you know what, these young generation team.
New generation?
Yeah.
Mark Batten and Johnny Wilhoit.
Yeah, Mark Batten and Johnny Wilhoit. They call me, same thing. They said, Tojo, you train Jerry Jarrett to be champion. You train Tom Reese to be champion. And they said that they like to be trained by me too. But I told them, same thing. If you come to my training camp, you pass my training camp, and all the exercise and all the treatment I give, if you pass with your good heart, I said, I train you. So I left them. And then I went to Hawaii. Now I come back. You understand, right, Mr. Lance Russell? Right. I called them up. I said, how's everything go? They said, very bad. I said, what you mean, very bad? They said, Randy Macho Man Savage beat them. I said, well, yeah, I know. Like Mr. Lance Russell, I said, that team is not good. They're not an inexperienced team and everything. I've been training them. But now today, I come here live. And I'm going to manage them, and I'm going to see them, and I'm going to give them the worst today.
Okay, so he's going to come in, and he's going to manage this team, the new generation, which, to translate it to the WWF-minded person from the 80s, think of them as sort of the young stallions, because what they were is they were basically being promoted as a newer version of the Fabulous Ones, which is a little strange considering that they're still right there. You can't really push something as being the new version of this when the old version is still there. You got to work it like the old Midnight Express and the new Midnight Express, where, you know, the quote original one comes in and attacks them. But this new generation, these two guys, are known for one thing, and it ain't having Tojo Yamamoto join them as a manager. They had a music video similar to what the Fabulous Ones had, because if you're trying to build them up like that, well, then you're going to copy some of the aspects that they had. And that meant having them do stuff in a music video. And let me tell you, when I saw this, it is one... There's nothing wrong with a extremely homoerotic video, but clearly that's not what they're going for. They're not working the Billy and Chuck gimmick. It is set to the song Let's Hear It for the Boy, which I don't know why the choice of song kind of cracks me up. The video starts with them riding ATVs, which apparently was taped at the Jarrett Ranch in Tennessee. Then they are kind of walking horses around and then are riding on them at a certain point. Then they're at the pool and they're wearing Speedos and they're pushing each other into the pool. They're diving in there. I mean, I thought that the Schmitz Gay commercial was going to break out in any second, you know, the old SNL skit. I mean, Billy and Chuck, they got nothing on this, and that's 18 years later. I mean, this is pretty insane for 1984 Memphis. And then you get the song playing in the background, and then the two men riding side by side in a horse-drawn carriage across the ranch, which I don't even know what to say about that. It's so unbelievably crazy, and I'm going to tweet out the link to that 3-minute video, which you should devote a little bit of time to actually watching. So their match coming up now is against another team with new in their name, the New Hollywood Blondes. So hopefully they can get a victory over them with Tojo there to add credibility. The new generation is Mark Batten and Johnny Wilhoit. As Tojo had said, they were refugees from the closed ICW promotion of Angelo Poffo. Now, the New Hollywood Blondes is Ken Timms and Dusty Woods, who I strongly believe is Dusty Wolf. I am 98% sure of that, so I'm going to go along with it. And the fact that they're calling themselves the Hollywood Blondes, they're, you know, in a lineage of different teams that call themselves that. And they are in the unfortunate position of not being as good as the team that came before them, and also not being as good as the team that came after them. So just completely forgettable in every aspect. Before them was the Hollywood Blondes with Buddy Roberts in the 70s, which lasted about 7 years. And then after that, you get the team of Steve Austin and Brian Pillman, one of the best tag teams of the 90s, albeit very, very short-lived. So that I have literally no idea what's going to happen in this match. You'd think that the new generation is going to pick up an easy win here, or maybe a hard-fought win, 6.5 minutes, something like that, where they go to Tojo for some advice. He's very clearly okay with gay people, if he had seen that video, which is nice to see in 1984 Memphis. So I'm kind of making assumptions based on them being promoted as a newer version of the Fabulous Ones. So Ken Timms and Mark Batten start out, And quickly we tag to Will Hoyt, who moves very fast after the blind tag. But I can tell he's a very short guy. So I compared them to the young Stallions earlier. I guess he would be the Paul Roma, where he is just noticeably small. Lands a drop kick on Wolf slash Woods. I'm pretty sure it's Dusty Wolf. I'm not as sure about these Memphis things as I am of, you know, from other promotions. Lance says that the drop kick reminds him of the one of Coco Ware, which is very high praise since he is one of the better ones ever. Then the referee, for whatever reason, gets distracted. I don't know if he's talking to Tojo or like trying to catch up or something. And Timms hits Will Hoyt with what appears to be like some sort of rope. It's the old, when he hits the ropes running, it's the old Bret Hart memorial transition spot.
He's not fucking dead.
I don't know why I keep forgetting that. I mean, after all, he was attacked by Rasta Man, or whatever the hell he was calling himself a couple weeks ago, at the Hall of Fame. So they start attacking Will Hoyt with this rope, and then all of a sudden we get the DQ called by the referee, and this attack just continues. And now I'm scratching my head, because clearly they want to make something out of this tag team, but I forgot, oh yeah, Tojo's there, so that's the actual reason for this match, is to establish that he's back and that he's a bit of a badass. So as the attack continues, Tojo has had enough, and he just climbs in the ring and starts chopping the shit out of both of these guys.
Lawler was talking about. He will beat you to death with that chop. Timms down again. Dusty Woods comes back and gets nailed. Woods still has that rope. And Yamamoto, he cleared the house out in a hurry.
Just strikes me as a little weird that this team that you're clearly trying to push, you did a music video for them, you put Tojo Yamamoto alongside to give them credibility, and you give them very little shine in this match, and it's over in 2 minutes and 15 seconds, and now you're just reestablishing Tojo. I don't quite get it unless they had just given up on these guys, given how that video had to have been perceived. It's just a little strange to me. I feel like you could have given them 5 minutes and then build to that a little bit differently. What's crazy to me is that even though, like I said, he was 57 years old, Tojo was working a regular schedule 84 into 85 in the territory. And he actually worked tag matches with Will Hoyt against these very same Hollywood Blondes the following Monday at the Mid-South Coliseum, so on July 16th. So he's there on the regular for another year. He even beat Randy Savage when the Macho Man was on his way out of town. So I'm glad to see Tojo in this kind of spot, because, you know, the circumstances of his death, which was a suicide in 1992, is very sad to think about. So sometimes you just got to go back and watch when these guys were really great, albeit a little bit long in the tooth. And I say that so long as they don't murder their entire family. That's the one caveat exception that I'm going to throw out there.
Brown ball to the right side. Pucho has it. And running over, and the Cardinals have done it. The St. Louis Cardinals, improbable in making the playoffs. And Ryan Howard is down. He is hurt halfway between home and first base.
Apologies to the Philadelphia contingent out there, but I have to comment on this. The Ryan Howard of the Philadelphia Phillies grounding out to end the 2011 series against the St. Louis Cardinals, tearing his Achilles tendon while going to first base. I can't think of a worse way to end your run in the playoffs than to have your best player now suffer an injury that will carry into the following season. And not only that, a torn Achilles tendon for a dude who's 31 and is big, it pretty much sidetracked him for the remainder of his career. He was just never the same. He had that big contract, but I think it was the Achilles tendon injury that just completely derailed him. The other thing about Ryan Howard, and I have no idea when I'm going to be able to bring this up ever again, not to channel my inner Conrad or anything, but it's amazing that Ryan Howard of the Phillies prime of his career ran from 2005 to 2011, which is the exact same time as the prime of the television show The Office, which had a character on it named Ryan Howard, one of them white, one of them black, And to cap it all off, they were born within like 3 or 4 months of each other. It's really kind of crazy. I do think that the writers of The Office may have known that Ryan Howard is coming up through the Phillies system and actually named him that on purpose. Because I know one of those dudes, I think Ken Tremendous on Twitter, who is Michael Schur, was one of the writers on The Office before doing Parks and Rec. I want to say that Ryan Howard of the Phillies eventually ended up guest starring on The Office in the last season, but everything after Carell left is pretty fuzzy to me. And that's the way I want to keep it, quite frankly. So coming up next, we have Poffo Mania, the team of Leapin' Lanny Poffo and the Macho Man Randy Savage taking on Ken Raper and John King. And I've said enough about Ken Raper's name. I mean, what else can you really say? But John King, he didn't go on to have a great career at CNN at some point down the road. I've actually seen him at Bruins games, too. So it's not just Brutus the Barber Beefcake, who is a public figure that actually shows up at these these events that I go to. It's so weird to see Randy Savage in such a small studio setting. I'll admit, I have not seen a lot of Angelo Poffo's ICW. So this window here in 84 and 85, where he is in Memphis mixing it up with Lance Russell, which we're going to see in a little bit, it's so crazy to see because he is one of the biggest stars in the world only like a couple of years later. And he actually gets some applause from the Memphis audience. I don't know what the dynamic was, whether when ICW closed, if those people followed the Poffos in and started watching CWA Memphis. I'm not sure of that, but I think it has to do with Randy Savage just being so goddamn cool that you can't help but have a percentage of the audience just root for this guy. And Savage, knowing that he is in Memphis, he stalls on the floor for a second to actually start this match versus Raper is in the ring. And he tosses, when Savage gets back in, he tosses him to the outside. And as they note, Dave and Lance, the incredible difference. I mean, I've talked about how weird, how there's always something off with Lanny Poffo that I can't quite put my finger on, or I just can't say out loud. I don't know which one it is. The difference between, like, how do these two dudes share the same genetic material?
Said it a lot of times. It is true. Both of these guys are excellent athletes, but and totally different in personality, too, Dave.
Yeah, personality and, well, style, too. A little bit of similarity in the style. They both like to go to the air a lot, and they are both quite athletic and agile.
They are famous for their aerial stuff. I mean, Savage, the big elbow, the double axe to the outside and inside the ring. And Poffo would do those flips where he would look very gymnastic-like as he would do them. Very Will Ospreay. I'd like to take 1984 Lanny Poffo in a time machine. I know, I'm picking on Ospreay, but he's the first name that comes up when I think of dudes who can do flips these days. So it should be an honor for him. I mean, quite frankly. Because Poffo, once again, he does a weird thing that isn't quite necessary. He does a headstand and then gets his feet around the man's head and does a head scissors that way. And then he just flips. I mean, what an oddball pairing this is. Because Randy goes on to commentary, yells a few things, Phil Hickerson style, to kind of boast and all of that. But John King answers with a drop kick because he is the most trusted name in news. Then he goes for a body slam on Lanny, and he can't quite complete it. I think Lanny got a shot in on him because there's absolutely no way you do the spot where you try to slam the fat guy and then you kind of fall over with Lanny Poffo, who weighs like 219 pounds or whatever. So Savage is in. He comes off the second rope. A double, it doesn't look like it's formal double axe. It almost looks like a kind of a forearm shiver or whatever. King ends up on the outside, so you know what that means. Savage up to the top, double axe off the top to the outside. Of course, no padding out there in that Memphis television studio. And as King gets back in, he dodges, he goes through Savage's legs, and he tags Ken Raper on the way in, who then hits knees in the corner. And Lanny comes in with a knee to the head of Ken Raper as the Macho Man holds him. And then scores with a moonsault that is technically sound, I guess. It's done ultra safely because I'm not sure how you do a moonsault without even making contact with the man on the mat. But somehow Lanny Poffo is able to do it. But Nobody else is doing it in 1984, hardly, or at least Americans. So he does deserve some level of credit for that. He covers and then pulls the man up at one because big brother has got to get in there. Now, I forget which one is actually older, but it doesn't matter because Randy Savage is the big brother because he ended up becoming more famous. So I'll give you one guess how Savage finishes the man off. No, not the big elbow. You are wrong. He puts him up on the second, on the top turnbuckle, that is, and with a superplex. I never have seen Randy Savage do a superplex. His whole time in WWF, WCW, maybe my memory is failing me, but I certainly, you know, in his high-profile matches, that's not something he ever busted out. Of course, that was a different era where you weren't doing suplexes as, you know, false finish, transition spots, that sort of thing. And that is how Poffo Mania picks up the win. Now, like I said, I would have chosen a different name than Poffo Mania just because it feels like it's aping off somewhere else. But then again, we're still in kind of a rigid territory system that is slowly breaking down, and Memphis somehow defies those laws and survives longer than others. It's its own world, so I guess I'm going to allow it. I don't have any strong feelings about the Texas Rangers one way or the other, but whenever I watch that 2011 World Series Game 6 clips from that game, it physically pains me how close they got to winning the World Series on numerous occasions during that game. On that freeze triple, they are one strike away. Nelson Cruz can't catch the fly ball, which is sad because Cruz had homered earlier in the game. I know he had a PED suspension a couple years later, but he's great for the 2014 Orioles, and he's been, you know, a real mensch since then. So, anyway, in the 10th, Josh Hamilton, another great redemption story, hits a two-run homer, so you think, oh, well, clearly they're going to close it out this time, but for some reason they go to 86-year-old Darren Oliver to try and close out the Cardinals in the 11th. They score two runs there, too, a clutch hit by Lance Berkman with two outs and two strikes, and then Freeze hits a walk-off homer in the bottom of the 11th. And I feel bad because the Texas Rangers had literally not even advanced to the World Series in their 50-year history until the year before that. They lost badly, and then they come so close, and since then, it's been just kind of a, you know, they trended downhill for a while, and now they're definitely in a rebuilding mode. But I do that not to pick on them, although there will be another 2012 Rangers thing, or two coming next week for the year 2012. It's just they entered my life during that period of time. And, you know, I can't help but point it out. So, up next, as I played in the opening intro to the show, Rock and Roll Express versus Poffo Mania. And this is just a clip of a 9-minute match. But holy hell, do we get the best part of this clip. It is from CWA Star Wars because apparently it was a national law between 1982 and 1984 that every single wrestling super show had to be called Star Wars in some way. Everything is a Star War. I mean, what the hell? You know, you'll be shocked to learn that not everybody in the world has actually watched Star Wars. I mean, I have, but honestly, I'm not going to give grief to those people because I've never watched Game of Thrones, and I have no real desire to. I also have never watched The Wire, and I don't really feel like watching The Wire because now I'm that guy who's never watched The Wire. And I know that excludes me from a lot of white people conversations because white people be talking about The Wire is like totally a thing. So anyway, this whole incident, being somebody who was not born and raised in Memphis, who wasn't, you know, steeped in all this history. I learned about this from the David Shoemaker book, which, you know, may be flawed factually at various points, but it's a good read to, you know, for a fan to refresh themselves with stuff that had happened in the past. And the Macho Man, it was taken a lot of the stuff from that book from his Dead Wrestler of the Week columns, because it seemed to be centered around that, because unfortunately we've lost so many greats at a younger age. And I never knew about this Savage pile driving Ricky Morton through a table, which if you say that to somebody who doesn't know about this, like, oh, big deal. Well, it was 1984. Yeah, so, and you just want to scream, It had never happened before, people. I don't mean to be the old man yelling at a cloud, but when somebody does something for the first time, it's kind of a big freaking deal. Like the person who invented nachos, and I actually looked it up. It was some maitre d' in Mexico who did it for the wives of American soldiers, something like that. I should have written down the name, the person who invented nachos, but there is a person. Or the person who thought to smoke grass for the first time. I mean, somebody had to do that. And same thing, somebody had to think, you know what, I'm going to pile drive somebody through a table. And that had to be done for the first time. So, of course, it would be the Macho Man, Randy Savage. So as we go to our clip, you're going to be shot. I hope you're sitting down when I tell you that Ricky Morton was in peril in this match. And he's tossed to the outside, Savage with the double axe from the top to the outside. No big whoop. I mean, nobody was doing that in 1984 either, probably because it was going to kill their knees. But Randy Savage was always willing to make such sacrifices for the betterment of everyone, especially his career. He's tossed in, Morton is, but he's kept from making the tag to Robert Gibson. But Lanny, once he is in there, he misses a somersault splash, yet another thing you didn't see very much back in those days. And finally, Ricky is able to make the tag to Robert, who he's running the ropes, and the Macho Man pulls the rope down, and Robert goes over it at a pretty good speed. I mean, that looked quite good the way that they did it. A lot of times you might have like a hesitation, like, all right, I gotta make sure I don't fall on my head. Robert Gibson approached it like, yeah, I've done this before. Yeah, I can go over these ropes at a pretty good speed and make it look damn good. So the DQ is called by the official at the 9-minute mark. We only probably got to see about a minute and a half of this. But now we get the best part, because Gibson is on the outside and Morton, he's still kind of recovering from before. Now, this is something that isn't pointed out in the Shoemaker book that talks about this whole incident, is Randy and Lanny tried to spike pile drive Gibson before any of this goes on out on the floor. But Morton does make his way over and he breaks it up. And Angelo Poffo, who is seconding his sons at all times during this, and for whatever reason on the TV, he was wearing a thing on his back that had like a four, it almost looked like Nails's jacket where it had like a bunch of numbers. I think it said like 605. I don't know if that means he's going to listen to the 605 Super Podcast or something like, I don't know what that was. So Angelo takes a shot at Morton, and that is how he is incapacitated enough where he is then put onto the table, and that is where, quote, it happens.
Now the ball's right out as we back up right on the table. Savage has it on the table. What is he doing? He's trying to power drive him on the table. He's trying to power drive him on our announcer's desk. Oh my God. Oh my gosh. He broke the table. Rick Morton, as we need some help. Savage, come on, Randy. Randy, this is ridiculous.
There are so many amazing things about this. Number one, it's a pile driver in Memphis, which, as I've said before, is equivalent with certain death. I mean, that's why you have the whole, the pile driver is banned and all that sort of stuff. Okay. But he's doing it on a table. It's the first time anything like that had ever been done. Tables were not designed to break like that back in those days. I mean, it wasn't done for the safety of guys to actually break it. I like the table manufacturer who actually has to make the tables that will then be broken. It's actually a pretty good business. It's kind of like Apple designing phones that will die on you after 18 months. That's pretty much how it goes. Savage also becomes the only person named Randy to successfully break a table on the first try. You hear that, Randy Orton? See, somebody named Randall can actually break a table. If this was Triple H versus Batista from WrestleMania 35, they would still be there 21 minutes later trying to break it by any means necessary. It's so amazing, and much has been remarked about the crowd and how you can see these two dudes high-fiving, and yeah, there's a little bit of support there for the Macho Man because he's just that cool. And also, but the thing that strikes me is the hush in the crowd. It's basically like the Masters audience watching. It's like, like when a crowd just becomes stunned into silence, like that shit's real. You can't, like that's not manufactured. And it's very hard to do something like that, which makes this so historic. So, all right. So Ricky Morton's been put through a table. I guess he's going to be okay. because they are given their right of reply in the Model UN parlance. And luckily for us, and this is no disrespect meant to Robert Gibson, the ratio of how long Ricky should talk to how long Robert should talk should be at least 2-1, which is where it's at here.
You know, Rick, when we left the Mid-South area, we went looking for a national ranking. And, brother, we got that. You know, we're ranked in the top 5 in the world today. And we ain't about to come back home and let 3 punks, I'm talking about the Pop-O-Mania. Son, we ain't coming back here to let y'all make us out of a stepping stone, because you ain't looking at the old Rock and Roll Express. You're looking at the new Rock and Roll Express, baby. And we're going to show you why we're ranked in the top 5 in the world today.
Come on, Robert. I know you're probably just trying to be modest here, but just top 5 in the world? What are you trying to convince yourself that you guys deserve a berth in the Orange Bowl or something? The top 5 in the world? No, just say you guys are number 1. This is wrestling. Nobody's going to check unless it's some a-hole on a podcast 35 years later. But I'm much more interested in what Ricky has to say, because he's the damn one who got pile drive through a freaking table.
You know, the last time we wrestled these guys in Memphis, Tennessee, you stepped in the ring and you hit us with lefts, you hit us with rights, you even run my head in the post, and even got up on top and pile drive me on top of the table out on the floor. Well, brother, when that match was over, you still seen us get up and walk back to that dressing room, brother. Now I want to tell you just a little something, brother. Now, you can do all you want to, and you can say all you want to, but the Rock and Roll Express is coming back home. Now, it's tag teams like you that made us what we are today, made us what we don't care. And when you see us again, you're going to see why we don't care, brother. We're going to step in that ring, and we're going to beat you. Now, either you could fly with the Eagles, or you could scratch with the Chickens, brother. The Rock and Roll Express loves to fly high, and I'm telling you that right now. So, Randy Savage, Lanny Poffo, Angelo Poffo, do all you can, brother, because you're going to see the Rock and Roll Express. We're coming back home, brother. We're coming back home to take care of some business. Like I said before, we don't care what we do and how we do it. We're coming to win. We're not talking about putting your shoulders down on the ring for a 3 count. We're talking about winning. Now, I don't care if we have to roll out on the floor, get a chair, bring a chain, or even a baseball bat, brother. The Rock and Roll Express Revenge. Is coming back.
Revenge, baby.
And when we get through with you, brother, you're going to wish you never even heard of the Rock and Roll Express. Like I said, yeah, you hurt my neck, but my pride was hurt a heck of a lot more. And we're coming home. We're coming home to get you. So you remember, the Rock and Roll Express, the new one, we're coming back. Woo!
Your way.
Okay, fine. I think you've convinced me that I'll go to the arena and pay money to see the rematch. Fine, I guess. Rock and Rolls versus Poffomania. But we got another reply from the Macho Man and his brother Lanny, who is going to chime in. Where Savage, he's just kind of doing that nutso thing that you would see after he turns on Hulk Hogan when the Mega Powers explode. It is very similar to that, because the character is definitely there. But having Lanny there just kind of adds this weird intellectual element to the whole thing.
Oh, is that stupid, man? Because we make the Road Warriors look like little kids walking around the street. Half Tennessee, half the rock and roll.
Lance, I have to admit, I was viewing that tape with a great deal of skepticism. But after having seen it and judging it merely for its content, I have to say, when you sift out all the hey babies and the rock and roll jargon, of which I am not familiar, but I have made a study from a little bit behind the scenes, they don't care what they're going to do as long as they do it. In other words, the end justifies the means. In other words, the worst form of motivation is revenge. Revenge is one thing that no man should put us under, because there is no satisfaction that comes from revenge, even from victory. What we are talking about is decadent filth. Rock and roll, in its essence, is taking young men and women and making them slaves to sins of the flesh and sins of pleasure. I stand for courage, purity, honesty, humility, diligence, charity, and fidelity.
All right, this is definitely my favorite version of Lanny Poffo of all time, 1984 Memphis, just from watching this. Though I would have absolutely plotzed if Lance Russell said, sins of the flesh, wait a minute, weren't you the one I saw sucking his own dick backstage? You're going to talk about sins of the flesh? Come on. We'll be right back. If he had done something like that, because it's the first thing you think of with Lanny Poffo, if you've read anything on the internet about him. That's not his poetry or any of that. You were sucking your own cock. Don't talk about sins of the flesh. Oh, my God. Meanwhile, Randy Savage is hitting his own head with a chair, kind of walking back and forth in front. It's so insane. It's so great. I hope he didn't get CTE or whatever from just doing that. This is so freaking good. I mean, wow. Why couldn't we have seen these two together on a more regular basis in the WWF? I mean, there was a lot more magic to unlock. And I mean, the dad's there, Angelo, he's just walking around in the background. I mean, he's not doing anything. And it's not like he's running a lot of interference at ringside. Yeah, he threw that punch at Ricky Morton to set up the table spot. But he's doing his role quietly and letting his sons shine. As it should be, quite frankly.
Here's the 1-1 delivery. That is it!
And the collapse of the 2011 Red Sox was completed. I mean, if they had gotten into the playoffs, they just would have gotten routed in the first round, seeing that they lost 20 of their last 27 games. They were 9 games up for a playoff spot on September 1st. The whole team was all about chicken and beer and all that story. They had the loathsome Adrian Gonzalez at first base, one of my least favorite Red Sox players ever, complaining, "We had too many Sunday night games." Like, yeah, that's supposed to mean that your team is good. Why are you complaining about that? That's why Adrian Gonzalez, just never liked him from the get-go. And yes, that was my last game as a Red Sox fan. However, I did not become an Orioles fan because of that game. You're going to have to wait till next week for that story. So up now for our final match, we have the Memphis Super Friends joining forces, Jerry the King Lawler and the Fabulous Ones Stan Lane and Steve Kern taking on the Nightmares and Keith Robertson, which, yeah, he was there for a very long time, but I know I've overused this time machine cliche, but could we get Keith Robertson a cliche, put him in WCW in the mid-90s, team him up with the State Patrol, and call them Cops and Robertson? Hey, I don't care what you think. I actually sat through Cops and Robertson's in the theater in 1994. So, hey, I don't want to hear anything about it. As they come out, Lawler gets in the ring because he's the king. He's royalty. But the Fabs, they're men of the people. And then I realized, oh, yeah, Stan Lane is actually just kind of looking around to figure out if there are any women in this audience that he hasn't boned yet. In the greater Memphis area. I'm also, and I was going to point this out on some of the earlier matches, but Dave Brown would do the usual announcement from Memphis, Tennessee, 241 pounds, all that. And then when he gets to the end, he would say, "Jerry Calhoun is our referee," for which he was for every freaking match. You don't need to point out that he is the referee in every match because, yeah, we can see that it's the same guy every single time. He's the only person on hand. I mean, why pay two referees when you can go through the whole show with just one? So Lawler is going to start with Nightmare number one, who cheap shots the king in the corner. Feels like a bad decision. And he actually does it again, and Lawler answers with a right hand. Dave now makes an observation about Robertson, which, in listening to it, for whatever reason, I took this personally.
He goes about 242, 243. He is big, has a lot of potential. Unfortunately, he's kind of hooked up with some of the wrong friends here in this portion of his career.
I took it personally because that's very close to my own weight, and you could be saying the same thing about my actual career right now, given that I'm kind of stuck in this contract role, and I still haven't made full-time. I don't mean to make it a gripe fest about that, but for whatever reason, it got a little too real. I watch wrestling to escape. I don't need Dave Brown in, 35 years ago relaying facts about Keith Robertson that actually do apply to me. So we get a little miscommunication spot from the heels as Robertson holds Lawler, who then gets hit by one of the Nightmares. It doesn't really matter which one it is. It might have been two. It's either one or two. I haven't nailed down to that. So number two, Nightmare number two is in. He gets trapped in the corner, and Lane and Kern work him over for a bit. Then we get an exchange where Lawler and Robertson are in, and Lawler just swallows his ass up, as he should. And Lane, when he gets in there, a gut-wrench suplex suplex. So hearkening back to last week, we are no longer devaluing the Colonel Mustafa gut wrench suplex because that is the only one on this show. So glad to see that. A double backdrop by the Fabs. And Lawler ends it with, I didn't even see the tag to Lawler. Lawler just kind of comes off the second turnbuckle in the corner closer to the hard camera with the fist drop. And that is how the Memphis Super Friends pick up the win. There's really not a whole lot here other than to get all three of them on TV. And I have to admit, it's kind of delightful to see this trio in action. We go now to another promo for the Tuesday night show at the Louisville Gardens, and we heard from Rick Rude earlier, so now we are going to hear from his opponent in that one, Tommy Rich. And I was thinking about it, and like, yes, this is a battle of two ECW 1997 veterans. I believe Tommy Rich was in by that point as the Big Don, one of my favorite characters of all time. And yes, once again, I put out the call, why are there no pictures of the Tommy Rich Italian flag on the internet? We have a whole internet out there where you have two girls shitting into a cup, but yet we don't have a picture of the Tommy Rich Italian flag, like a clear one. So anyway, Tommy back in 84, he's pretty close to his prime. The last Battle of Atlanta with Buzz Sawyer was less than a year before this. He's going to be wrestling in a historic venue, the Louisville Gardens. You could think of it as almost a church of wrestling, but he has his mind on the Church of Poontang.
Thank you very much for the compliments. First of all, I'd like to say hi to all the pretty young ladies.
All I'm hearing from that is Tommy Rich saying, ladies of Kentucky, I'm back in town and I'm open for business. Hey, good enough for me. Whatever you want to do, Tommy Rich, just make sure you wear a glove. I mean, this is the mid-80s. Don't make me go on that jag again. And they do a quick wrap-up at the desk, but it cuts off very abruptly on the video. So that does it for CWA Memphis Wrestling from July 14th, 1984.
And when they left Boston for here, a leather-lung fan, and they have a few in Boston, yelled, we didn't lose to the British, and we're not going to lose to British Columbia. Hansen gave it across with 15 to go. Despite that adversity, they followed their coach to the high road, and the high road is the road to the cup. No icing. For the first time in 39 years, the Boston Bruins have won the Stanley Cup. And they pour on to celebrate with Tim Thomas, their heroic goaltender.
It's not just my favorite sports moment, it's just that it was the culmination of a build. Much like in wrestling, kind of you build a team up to compete for a championship. So in 2006, when I got season tickets again, they'd signed Zdeno Chara, and they were only a little bit better than the year before. Still bad. A little bit better the next season. Then a lot better the next season, lose early in the playoffs. Then they have a bit of a dip, lose in the playoffs, and then it builds to that championship right there on a five-year arc. And God knows I sat through enough cruddy hockey dating back a couple of decades that, you know, I was glad to actually win one for once. And no, I don't give a crap about Tim Thomas's political beliefs, because post-career, he has not exactly shoved it in everybody's faces. He just kind of retreated to his mountain lair in Colorado or Idaho or wherever he is, and he's not shoving it down people's throats like a certain pitcher for the Red Sox who had a bloody sock back in the day has done. So, I mean, I thought about doing a super cut at the end of this show with all the highlights and talking about them, but there's just too many of them. Time, there was three fights in the first 4 seconds of a game teaching you to always show up on time to your favorite sporting event. The 8-6 game against Montreal with goalie fight, which really wasn't much of a fight because they were just kind of horsing around. 7-0 win over Montreal. I don't mean to keep picking on Montreal, but 3 overtime wins against them in the first round, getting revenge against the Flyers, sweeping them in the second round. 7-game series win over the Tampa Bay Lightning. Game 7 of that series, the best hockey game that these two eyes have ever seen. A 1-0 game with no penalties called and no penalties where you can even argue should have been called. And then that series against Vancouver, which was very frustrating because they kept losing the close games in Vancouver and then beating the absolute shit out of them in Boston. Nathan Horton gets hurt, Aaron Rome gets suspended, and it leads to that Game 7 magic out in Vancouver. And we all hope that it is repeated again this year, although I should point out that it's kind of funny that the first round playoff tickets as a season ticket holder for the Bruins, for the first round, each game is more expensive now in 2019 than the Stanley Cup final was in both 2011 and 2013. They kind of figured out they could charge whatever the hell they want for the playoffs. Elsewhere in podcast land, beyond the Pro Wrestling Only feed, because the WorldCast podcast covered the July 4th show for World Class from 1983, Von Erichs versus Freebirds people. Do I have to sell it any more than that? Also, keeping the light on for Steve Bennett as he recovers from recent surgery. Sportscasters will be back soon, but of course he has an extensive back catalog with a lot of great interviews. Joe Buck, Richard Deitch, the list goes on and on, and Jeff Perlman, my personal favorite guest that he has had on. Now on the Our Vantage Point podcast with Little Joe Murata and Michael Quinn, they talk about Vader's evolution from the top guy in WCW to his ill-fated WWF run in 97 and 98. And I have to say, that is a very depressing topic, given just how great he was at one time. And on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing, a long-awaited episode with Mike Crockett and Brian Malonis as they discuss Brian wrestling at Madison Square Garden, having this little moment with Jushin Thunder Liger in the Honor Battle Royal at the beginning of the G1 Supercard. Mike Crockett refereeing at Brian's Astromania card that he promoted up in New Hampshire at the end of March. You're going to be shocked to learn that Mike Crockett showed up late to the event. And that was like literally the least surprising thing that I've ever heard in my life. But that was a great episode, and I encourage you to check that out. Now, on next week's Greetings from Allentown, I'm going to be covering this. I guess this is kind of in that Beer Trion program, like I mentioned earlier, going back once again to 1985 to October 26th. Yes, the very weekend that Marty McFly went back in time. So there'll be definitely more than one Back to the Future references. I mean, especially since there's a lot of Arn Anderson on this show, and Arn Anderson's real name is Marty. So, you know, what am I supposed to do with that? Magnum T.A. opens himself up to some Me Too treatment from Baby Doll. She likes it. She likes it. And Dusty Rhodes visits the doctor because he's got hard times. I mean, you know that deal. And there's a Midnight Express squash on that show. I mean, what do I need to say anything more than that? I mean, just some great stuff from Jim Crockett Promotions in 1985, the episode of Worldwide from October the 26th. I was going to do YouTube Comment Theater this week. However, I've already covered some of the ground from the comments that were listed, so I'll just kind of be repeating myself at this point. Besides, I'm at an hour and 36 minutes almost now, so I think it may be time to wrap it up. Once again, leave a 5-star review on iTunes, Apple Music. That is always appreciated. And also, tell a friend, because that is helpful as well. But when you leave that 5-star review on iTunes, Apple Music, if you sneak in, you know, something that you might want me to do in the future, obviously, that is the path to it, since not everybody can buy me beer in stadiums. You know, not everybody's going to have access to that sort of thing. You know, Richard Land did that at Madison Square Garden, so I probably owe him a show, now that I think about it, the coordinating producer of Greetings from Allentown. I'm going to roll credits right now and get out of here for this week. Thank you so much for listening, and tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.